like a primitive match. I left home to roam about the globe and got stopped at the bar, eavesdropping on Tarzan and Jane. I'm cheap as the dirt on an Armani shirt, and I'm stuck in the wrong part of town. Almost forgot that the stove will get hot. Another hint from above, where a strong love always wins. So lay your hands off of my skin. I've yet to begin. Let me clear my throat. I know your flaws, but I'm worried about them claws that are gonna rip me deep, and now you won't hear another peep out of me.
And that was Eli Charleston from his CD Ragged Time, The Sweat of Solid Ground. You're on solid ground here, maybe, sort of, with Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org if you're listening to us on the Internet. I'm Robert Norse, and this is Bathrop Spears Broadsides, Civil Rights in Santa Cruz, somewhere, we hope. We're going to find him. We're out a-looking. Going to find him. Today, I'm, as mentioned before, going to get into the Metro strike as soon as my guest, Paul Marcelin Sampson, arrives, and I'm hoping also to hear from Bonnie Moore and other members of the United Transportation Union. I've got some audio of that. I was by the strikers several times, actually marched with them because I'm a supporter of the strike. Paul, however, has a different view, I believe. We'll get his exact view when he gets into the studio. And it's not the view that perhaps the average Free Radio Santa Cruz listener or supporter might have. I don't know. Of course, hard to say who the average Free Radio Santa Cruz listener or supporter is. A collective member. I think most collective members probably support the strike. And as I do. And we're going to hear what Paul's thoughts are on this. He's talked about it on the air before. He's with the Metro Writers Union. We'll be talking with him in a bit. While I'm waiting for him to show up, I'm going to play you a little bit of a Santa Cruz City Council meeting from 2 weeks ago. Actually, it's a speech I gave at the Santa Cruz City Council meeting. This was actually my first oral communication speech in, well, probably since June 14th. I was at council, I think, one other time when I was arrested for standing at the microphone and waiting for my 2 minutes to speak on the another union issue across the street. Let's hear that, and then we're going to hear some fireworks, or perhaps, who knows, some waterworks. I may start crying. You never can tell what's going to happen. Here we go.
FEMA boss Brown sneaks out the back door. Bush's concertina wire camps go up at Tal Afar, Iraq. And at the city council, it's business as usual. No campground, car park, or sleeping van repeal for our own homeless refugees. No rent control for renters or Clearview Court Latinos or De Anza seniors ripped off by the Rodkin Matthews Council. No attack on profiteering speculators for low-wage drudges downtown who do the dirty work but can't afford to live here. No community control of police. No end to selective enforcement or ban on police use of lethal tasers as our SCPD continues on its way. And for those trying to keep an eye on the slippery gyrations of our city manager for life, Dick Wilson, it's getting increasingly hard to follow the money on the afternoon agenda. For instance, items 13 and 14 didn't even have specific money amounts attached, either in the agenda or the staff report, just the rosy reassurance funds are available. Most of the public business happens via this quick and dirty afternoon consent agenda, and a new time limit, as mentioned before, permits a member of the public to speak on only two or three items at most before being silenced. The new Rodkin Porter 5-minute gag rule essentially blocks any meaningful public comment on most consent agenda items. If you insist on your right to speak, you may get an inkling of what Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo feels like. I certainly did, when on June 14th, I was dragged from this microphone by Lieutenant Steve Clark, violently assaulted here right here. With the cameras and microphone turned off, I was subsequently arrested on the order of Mayor Rotkin. I now face a year and a half in jail and a trial scheduled to begin October 24th. On the streets, city staff are engaging in a more nitty-gritty repression against punks, youth, homeless, poor people, such as those who gather at Elm and Pacific Streets downtown across from the metro. There, a bench has already been removed without a public hearing, and a change-making machine is ready for installation. Within 100 feet of two other change-making machines right across the street, clearly a social cleansing device designed to remove the unsightly from the downtown without benefit of public process, of course. In 1994 and 2003, council members Rutkin and Matthews gave us some of the most repressive city laws in the state. These laws make 95% of our sidewalks in all business districts illegal to sit on and 75% illegal to perform at or to politically table at. Merchants, police, and the redevelopment agency remove area after area from public use. Gone is a public sitting space at the only five planters on Pacific we have. Gone are the benches from the sidewalk in front of the Pacific Cookie Company, Borders and the Vets Hall, and now Elm and Pacific. When I asked them why the benches in the past were removed, we only have half the number of divisions Santa Cruz had before.
Your time is up.
I was told that there's no record. We don't know. Thank you.
And that was a couple of weeks ago at City Council, not the last City Council meeting, which happened, only 2 days ago. I have some tape on that, too, and I apologize for the quality of that tape. It's much better off of the video, but unfortunately, I'm in the process. I mean, I've moved, and I don't have a place to stay, so I'm using the facilities of other generous people who are letting me crash here and there, and sometimes their video machines don't work either, so I'm running about making do and sometimes making do-do, a mix a little of both. So be patient with me. I hope you could hear some of that speech. And as far as I know, there's been no response from the mayor, the city council, the Parks and Rec as to why the rationale behind the putting in of the change machine, the removal of the benches, the fact that the number of benches on Pacific Avenue has diminished by half from the plan that was done by Vision Santa Cruz. Some call it Darkness Santa Cruz. But in this case, at least Vision Santa Cruz wanted to retain some of the benches. We have some benches downtown, but less than half on Pacific Avenue that were originally even slated to be there in the plan. Of course, before the earthquake, there were massive numbers of seating areas all over the place, beautiful red brick planters, shady nooks, you name it, and it was, we had our problems big time, of course, still, police harassment, selective enforcement, all kinds of things, but it was a much different kind of environment and quite unique, and that's gone. The earthquake, of course, just like in New Orleans, and with the hurricane, became the opportunity to redevelop a neighborhood into an upscale, sterile, gentrified scene, and that's, of course, what I continue to fight, however quixotically, however much of a sort of retreating action it is. Now, in the studio with me shortly, he's actually here, but I'm going to give him an opportunity to get his figures together, is Regis Paul Marcellin Sampson, who's a founder or co-founder or certainly one of the sinister masterminds behind the Metro Writers Union, which he's been attacked on Santa Cruz Indie Media as a I'm not sure what the latest attack on you was. Do you remember, Paul?
I don't know. I haven't been reading indie media recently because the attack started during the Measure X campaign. And often when people can't respond with real information, they resort to name-calling and attacks. So
no.
I've shied away from that. I had been warned about that here in Santa Cruz.
Well, I know you were reluctant to come on and discuss this issue in the last month and a half because you actually feared your arrival might precipitate a strike.
I was concerned that, a sort of face-to-face, down-and-dirty discussion of the actual figures and the contents of the contract, which I have here also. You might want to remind your listeners that we're looking at the real thing here, the actual document. But I was worried that kind of tête-à-tête discussion could be a provocation, and I didn't want to be involved in
You're showing me a very thick 185-page book with a picture of a bus on it with a bicycle up adhering to the front of the bus. United Transportation Union Local 23, Santa Cruz Metropolitan Transit District, 1999 to 2002, labor agreement.
And look inside the cover, too, and you'll see that the sticker extends that through July of June of 2005.
And the fine print says final agreement between the Santa Cruz Metropolitan Transit District and the United Transportation Union Local 25 for the contract period starting on July 1st, 2002 through midnight, June 30th, 2005. What happened at midnight, June 30th, 2005, Paul?
They were still negotiating. Nothing of great significance really happened until the actual strike, which was unannounced and started at midnight Tuesday this week.
And that, of course, is a matter of some concern for some people that the strike happened 6 hours after it was announced. I guess it was announced at 6 o'clock, and then it came and happened at midnight.
It's not clear to me that there ever was an announcement, per se. Certainly there was no notification to Metro, and Metro staff had to guess around 10 o'clock, I assume, before calling it a night. They had to make a guess at 10 and post a message on their website, and then someone came in and posted again at midnight.
Because what I heard, I got the word that there was a strike happening the evening before from the evening news via a caller who said, did you see the evening news? They announced they were striking at midnight tonight.
I don't have TV at home.
Well, there you are. Without indie media, without TV, just what kind of a Metro Writers Union person are you, Paul Marcelin Sampson?
Let's just say I read the papers and I read the documents and I go to the board meetings, and that's where the real information comes down.
I should say that before we go any further, those of you who have different points of view who want to challenge this this advocate here for, I guess you would call yourself an advocate for writers seeking lower rates, or are you a management stooge? What's the answer here, Paul?
I have no connection whatsoever with the management, and my interest in this is in maintaining service levels and avoiding drastic fare increases and avoiding drastic service cuts. We've had both in the last 3 years. So that's my concern. That's where the money comes from. To operate the transit system comes from taxes, and obviously tax revenue is pretty much flat. I'd say anemic would be a good way to describe that. And then from fares, and so you have the choice of raising fares and or cutting service when people demand more money from you, when employees demand more money from you.
For those who want to talk about this issue, you can call Free Radio. It's 831-427-3772. Free Radio is going through something of a small crisis here. A worm has hit our computer, and we are losing our files big time. So if you've had, you know, some concerns about our programming, and you probably will, you should understand that we're not sure if we're under attack, or you know, whether God has decided we're a bad station or whatever it is, but we're having troubles here, so be patient with us. But the phone lines are open, 831-427-3772, 831-427-FRSC is the number to call. If you've got questions or comments on the strike or on what you hear here, you're welcome to call in. You can also go online, www.pagesincolor.com, which is a chat room where only I seem to be maintaining a lonely presence there, but you can jump on board in case you can't reach us or you don't want to by phone. That's a place to go, and I'll try to occasionally check that area. I'm going right now to the transportation UTU strike. That's the Union of United Transportation Union. I have invited Bonnie Moore to call in. She has called in several times in the past, and have been able to reach her by phone. But as I mentioned before, she's probably engaging in negotiations, which, as I understand it from today's Sentinel, always a sterling source for information. You detect the sarcasm in my voice. So it may or may not be true, but at 5 o'clock today, it was when negotiations were supposed to be resuming on the issue of the strike after, I guess, this is the third day of the strike. Here is what the issues are according to the union. At least this is the union description of it. Members of UTU Local 23 went on strike Tuesday after the Santa Cruz Metropolitan Transit District Board rejected an agreement that would have staved off a work stoppage. The union remains solidly united, bolstered by the backing of many in the community, as well as fellow UTU members from the state and national level. Bundled in fleeces and hats, a group of about 25 bus drivers after midnight Tuesday morning, September 27th, on River Street, carried strike signs and cheered as the last of Santa Cruz Metropolitan Transit District buses rolled into the transit yard, according to the Sentinel. Many present were familiar faces from board meetings. Others would rotate in on six-hour shifts later in the day at this and three other locations, again, according to the Sentinel. And skipping some sort of exclamations by various union members, drivers moved to strike after Friday's Metro board meeting. When directors rejected a tentative agreement between negotiating teams from Metro and the union, the board's decision left operators working under a contract imposed by the board last month. And that contract, I guess, the union had said was not acceptable to them. After Friday's fallout, drivers announced Monday evening, September 26th, they would walk off the job that night. That left 23,000 residents looking for rides or other solutions. Along with River and Encinal Streets, members of Local 23 walked the line on Pacific and at the Watsonville Transit Center, carrying signs reading, UTU on strike, good workers deserve good benefits, is a fair contract too much to ask? Mike Anderson, UTU's assistant state legislative director, who I believe we have some tape on later in the show, brought some signs from a previous strike in Roseville. We've had them since 1970, and every strike has been successful. They're good karma. Treat us fairly, said driver and negotiating team member Tony Herrera. We're going back to the bargaining table. That's a good beginning. Resting a picket sign against his shoulder, Herrera also spoke about riders. It pains drivers to leave them stranded, too. It would be one thing if the group worked for a corporation where it was just union management. Here, there's a middleman. If talks resume, Herrera said all topics will be back up for discussion. Drivers also want a contract for no less than 3 years. We don't want the public to have to go through this again. On Tuesday evening, General Chairperson Bonnie Moore addressed the City Council meeting, explaining the UTU's position on the fact that there was a signed agreement to keep the buses running. A few individuals have forced the strike action without thought of the public or the drivers, Moore said. You get the feeling there is a lot of support for the union, especially after the facts are brought out. After the meeting, Moore said the rank-and-file members of her local had expressed grateful appreciation for the support they received from the International and the stage legislative director. Sentinel editorial expressed the opinion the strike could do permanent damage to this area's transit system and took the union members to task for giving little notice of when the strike would start, but also noted drivers were angry, perhaps rightly so. They thought they had a temporary agreement with the district to operate under a compromise contract, at least for several months, until a new contract could be written. And there's more to that, but we have a caller, so let's see who that is. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Paul and Robert.
Oh, hi. Chris Brosden.
Chris, is this about the strike? Because that's what we're talking about now.
No, it's not.
Can you call back a little bit later?
Sure.
I appreciate that.
What time?
About an hour.
Sure.
Thanks.
Bye.
Let me turn down the speaker in the studio and continue with the Sentinel deal. And then give you an opportunity to comment, Paul. Believe it or not, you will have an opportunity to say something. Drivers do, in fact, face steep increases. This is the Sentinel writing, not always the union's best friend. Face steep increases in medical insurance costs, and they've requested help from the district in solving the problem, perhaps asking the drivers to understand the grim financial realities of the district is asking too much. The editorial continues, it's difficult to ask workers to give up on benefits they've negotiated for themselves in past years. That's why we believe the district officials and the board of directors have acted irresponsibly, according to the Sentinel. Taxpayers and bus drivers deserve better. Meanwhile, well, why don't we stop there for the moment and give you a chance to respond to this, it sounds like mixed criticism by the Sentinel and, of course, a vague description of some of the issues. I want you to go into the specifics, but first, your general reaction to this article?
Just a quick correction. It was at bus riders and taxpayers, not bus drivers and taxpayers deserve better. The Sentinel was, I think, overall taking the side of the riders.
Correct.
Who depend on the service.
Quite right.
And the taxpayers who help pay for it. I think that story, parts of it seem to exaggerate the support for the union. There's a lot of internal commentary from people who work for UTU, the National Legislative Director, other people like that. There isn't much there from people on the street who are affected by this service or from people who pay for it. And I can say just from a general perspective, I've been fielding calls and getting emails from people who are really frantic. You know, there are situations where you feel like turning away and crying because, and I'm not being dramatic in saying that, but the situation is so desperate for some people. I received an email message from a couple in Felton the other day, and the two parents work in South San Francisco. They have a very long commute, and they have three children, and one child is an elementary school kid and so has school bus access, and the other two children are older, and so they do not qualify for school bus. There is no school bus for older kids, and they have no way to get to school. It's a four-mile walk on roads that have no sidewalks in the San Lorenzo Valley area. And, you know, there's nothing to say to people like that. There's no help. There's nothing that can be provided to them. And I got a call from a senior yesterday who was shut in her home. We spoke for about 2 hours. We had met at a public hearing for Metro last year. She remembered me and called me. And she has no way to get groceries or other things like this. And we were kind of going through, well, you know, does this grocery store deliver? What are the possibilities? Who are people you can call? Will the carpool service help you if you're not commuting to work, if you're just trying to go to the store, to the doctor, other questions like that? So there's not much in that Sentinel article to speak to that perspective.
Although I think the Sentinel did cover some of that, and the Mid-County Post did cover some of the concerns of writers in the, you know, the discussion leading up to the strike.
Oh, and in other articles in the same day and the same papers. Just notice that those other articles were not selected for display on the UTU Central National website, which is where you were reading this particular selected article.
That is correct. Well, let's go back and kind of get back to the nitty-gritty on this, although it would be nice to have a union spokesperson in the studio, too. And if anybody's listening, please call in if you have anything you wish to dispute with or add or comment on around what we're talking about here. You have talked to me about this off the air, and I guess you've given me somewhat of a better understanding, though there's still aspects of this that remain a mystery to me, as Wilbur Buckley might say. But the issue here is not really wages. The issue here is medical benefits and, what's the word, guaranteed leave, or what's the phrase that's used to describe that that
in this case so-called general leave.
General leave, that's it. You want to give us the quick and dirty version of what the differences are between the management and the union.
Okay, well, first of all, I have to say that the actual negotiations, of course, take place in closed session, and discussions about them take place in closed session, so it's not possible to find out exactly what is going on. State law does not allow the public, when collective bargaining is in place, to participate, other than by commenting with very scant information, so I'll do my best. First of all, you said that it's not about wages. Every single contract, any kind of labor situation, is about money. Every word in a contract has a cost, and whether the money is spent on wages or on health benefits or on vacation time or on whatever else, it's all about money, and it's about an exchange. How much money for how much work? You do 1 hour of work, how much will you be paid? So the specific manifestations of this in this particular dispute were, first of all, health insurance. And just to be clear, the Metro Board, as of September 1st, has dramatically reduced health insurance costs for spousal coverage, that's two people, or, you know, one parent and one child, and for families, one spouse and one child, or any number of dependents. And this is effective September 1st. This is already in place.
Let me interrupt you for a minute here, Paul, because you put this, we can discuss this, if I can summarize it rather than get lost in the details, which, because you've got a lot of details, and necessarily to come to a general understanding, you need to understand the specifics. But tell me if I'm wrong in stating that the health benefit situation is this, that up to September 1st, the union was was paying what percent, and the county was paying what percent, or the management was paying what percent?
Well, it depended on how many people you wanted to cover. So if you were single, your health insurance had always been free, and it was still free.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about where there's an issue.
Okay, so then if you had one dependent, in other words, coverage for two people, yourself and one dependent, you used to pay $179 a month, and that was only true for 1 year. That was new. Before that, it had been free.
Again, the details. I'm trying to say, was it 90%? Was it 10%? Was it 5%?
I don't have the percentages, just the amount that people would have been paying $180 a month to cover themselves and a spouse or one child. And this was for 1 year, and it was the situation until before September. And then if you had a family, that's yourself, spouse, child, or any number of dependents, you were paying $400 a month. And that has been reduced now to $115.
That was the big issue, right?
Yes. That last one.
In the family situation, the amount of money that a bus driver or worker with the bus drivers union would pay would be, and these are all pretty much bus drivers, right? Everybody who's on strike.
Yeah, this category is all for bus riders, bus drivers.
Bus drivers. Yeah, getting you confused, I can see there. They were paying. A typical bus driver was paying what, $900 a month or $800 a month compared for this, not a typical one, but in this particular category.
No, $400. If you had a family, you were paying
$400. They were paying $400 a month, and the management was paying $600.
And Metro was paying $600.
And Metro was paying $600. Yeah. And now, as of September, Metro would pay $900, and a union member would only pay $100. So
exactly.
It looked like a much better deal. And they even offered to drop that even further, as you told me, in January as part of a contract where they would pay slightly, the union would pay slightly less, management would pay slightly more. And the union said, no, that's okay. We want to keep our general leave, so we'll agree to pay more in January, $250 or something.
Yeah, and it's actually, the union basically tendered an offer that would have caused an increase in June. It's a complicated
next
mess.
June,
yes,
you mean?
In June. It's a complicated situation because Metro is a unit of the state of California. All state agencies
don't bother to explain why.
Okay. Well,
I believe you.
Difference in calendar year and fiscal year.
Right. So
snap back.
But the union has offered to pay more for health benefits. The problem, however, is that the specific item that the Metro District is concerned with is general leave, which is that which allows people to leave without pay but with benefits, which means costly health insurance, and it requires the Metro to pay that to union members when they're not working, and they can take off a series of up to 4 to 6 weeks, I believe. Is that right?
Oh, actually, we have some people who have signed up for 3 and 2 months in a calendar year for this coming for the fiscal year that goes through July.
This is on general leave or general leave plus?
General leave.
Right. So you can, and right now, as you explained it to me, if you're very senior, even without general leave, you can use your sick leave whenever you want. Whereas if you're a less senior driver, contiguous sick leave. You can only get contiguous sick leave in the summer, right?
Oh, no. Sick leave you can use whenever you want.
Right,
there's no restriction on that. That's if you're sick. Vacation time.
Vacation time you can only get as a contiguous block altogether, continuous time in the summer. And the drivers are saying, we need it for stress purposes, for other concerns, just to keep healthy and so forth. We need to be able to do that at a time of our choosing, and 15 drivers did that, and the management says that costs us, A, because we have to, hire new drivers, and B, because we have to pay the health benefits during that period of time still, although we don't have to pay the wages. It costs as much as hiring on 2 new people to pay for 15 people taking general leave. Is that what they were claiming?
Yeah, it's actually more than that, and the costs are not obvious. But for every 1 month of general leave, you're looking at a cost of between $2,200 or so in the best case, and in the worst case, $4,500. And that's a very scary thing. That's not free time.
Now, union members claim that there are ways to pay this that could be done, and you've expressed some skepticism about this.
Well, basically, the union proposed us an offer that would have caused a snapback in the health insurance rates. The health insurance rates would have gone back up in June of next year, and as a result, the union would have kept its general leave. So that was the union's suggestion for paying for it.
What does a snapback mean? I'm not quite sure I understand.
Health insurance rates would have crept back up. Gone up dramatically.
The amount of money that the Metro pays for health insurance?
That the employees pay for health insurance would have increased. Basically, all of the employees would have been paying more in health insurance in June so that 15 could go on their 2 to 3 month or 1, 2,
and
or 3 month.
Are you suggesting that this is some sort of privileged deal for 15 or so people? I mean, is it available to anybody in the union, or is it available only to a select upper crust of the union?
It's all seniority. Everything is seniority based. And they ran a report which appeared on the Metro website today listing not the names of the employees, but their seniority and who's involved. And it's most of the, or I think it was up to 40% of the slots are taken by people who are taking more than 1 month. I want to be clear also that only the first month has the free benefit part. Months after that, you pay for your own benefits, but you know, it's not free either, because you're replaced by someone who's working overtime and who's more senior than you, because overtime goes first to the most senior people. So, again, it's a cost of $2,200 to $4,500 a month.
So again, that's a meaningless figure to us unless we understand the whole budget. So, again, I'm kind of looking for the general picture. This general leave that the union wants, the union itself voted to keep the general leave, so that union members apparently want it. They feel it's a fair deal, right?
I don't understand what their internal process was. I don't know whether the new offer was ever put to a vote by the union. I'm really not sure. I know that it was voted on, or that it was not ratified by the Metro Board. I don't know what the union did.
And actually, I heard that they voted on the strike, but I haven't heard about the specific proposal, so I can't really speak on that. And actually, that's something I did not ask union members that I spoke to, and perhaps I will.
Yeah, I mean, we can assume that they voted on either that or on the previous on the district's proposal, one or the other. I know they did vote on the district's proposal, but they didn't like it, and then they came forward with their new proposal.
But again, I'm trying to understand this. You are, in essence, it sounds to me like you're criticizing this proposal not just because of the costs to the transit district, and presumably then through that to the community and raised fares and cut schedules and cut routes, but also because it's essentially every union member is going to pay more for health benefits, so that a few, and you're suggesting those with seniority only will be eligible for this stuff, or mostly will be eligible, or everybody will be
eligible? There are 36-month person months. In other words, at any time, between 2 and 5 people can be off on this leave. So there are 36 slots each year, and of course those go in seniority order. And they're all claimed for the coming year already.
So this is are you suggesting this is a sweetheart deal for the seniority folks at the top of the union?
Well, I mean, seniority is a union concept. It's for the union to decide whether people want that or not. But I'll quantify the costs. The general leave will cost each union member between $600 and $1,100 a year. For the 145 drivers, that's what each of them is giving up, so that the people in those 36 slots, 15 or so people, can get their general leave.
And the 15 people are likely to be those with seniority, or actually will necessarily be those with seniority.
Yeah.
And what was the case this year? There were 15 people who took this. How many of them had, were part of the seniority group?
I don't have the full seniority rundown for all of them, just the ones who took more than 1 month. And so we have here employee number one who took... they're numbered. Of course, we don't have the names. Let's see. Sorry. Let me give you the rundown. Of the people who took general leave last year, five of those drivers were hired in 1980 or before. So we're talking more than 25 years seniority. 8 were hired from 1981 to 1990, and 7 were hired before 2000.
So it sounds like the majority of those were older drivers, or at least had been with the district longer, with the union longer.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of any dissent in the union about this? Because I haven't.
I have not either, and I that's a question I keep on asking. I haven't had a chance to discuss this with individual drivers, and people assume for some reason that I'm against ordinary drivers couldn't be further from the truth. As you can see, this is a pretty costly proposal for everybody, and only those at the top can get it. But it's a discussion I haven't been able to have with the drivers.
Well, not only those at the top, but certainly those at the top get it first, right?
Yeah.
Now, you say it, so it's limited to 36 slots a year, which means for general leave, and again, reminding folks out there who don't know, this is the provision that allows you to take, if you're a driver, a month off without pay, but with your medical benefits in case something happens to you or your family during that period of time. And again, that would be paid for at a very low rate, and for the, until June, if I understand it, you would be paying a union member would only be paying like $100, and the district would be paying $900 for a family. And then when June hits, we go back up to union pays $400 and the district pays $600.
Employee pays $272 was the snapback, so more than doubling. Right. And then district would pay $700 and change, let's say.
Well, you know, my reaction when I first heard this, I'm hearing this, I found myself wondering, but again, I found myself saying, well, if union members want to do this, it's really their choice. And again, the question arises, what about, you know, the funding situation in the district? I mean, frankly, whenever I hear Rotkin's name attached to anything, as Goebbels used to say in Germany in the good old days, you know, whenever I hear the word culture, I reach for my gun. I kind of wonder if Rotkin is a big booster of this. And actually, he was on both sides of this, as you may remember. First, he praised the union and the management or the Metro District for coming to this agreement. And then apparently he championed the destruction of this agreement at the next Metro Transit Board meeting. What do you make of that?
Well, as far as Rotkin and his take on numbers, I quite agree with you. I don't think he always has a clear grip, whether that's intentional or unintentional, I don't know. But he doesn't always have a clear grip on the numbers. But I do, and I took the budgets, and I've spent really the whole day preparing for this. So I'm prepared to answer any questions you want about the budget.
And the phones are ringing off the hook here, man. In case you want to ask any questions about this, and all you union members who probably aren't really listening to our show anyway, but if you are, or all you sympathizers, union sympathizers, what's the deal? Let me get a little more inflammatory. Are we suffering a strike here in order to feather bed activity for a few top union people? I mean, is that what's going down here? I came on and announcing myself as a supporter of the strike. I remain a supporter of the strike, but again, I'm not. That doesn't mean I can't change my mind. And I've got the questions here, and Paul Marcel and Sampson has got the data. We need some response from the union, and of course, probably they're in the midst of hefty negotiations, but we're not getting it at the moment. Number to call, 427-3772. Looks like somebody has joined the chat room. Hello there, Woman of Steel. Thank you for jumping on the chat room. If you have any questions or comments, please put them through, and I'll pass them on to Uncle Paul here.
Hello, Woman of Steel, also, I noticed.
This is the same Woman of Steel that Santa Cruz Indie Media, of course, bans from its sacred pages, which I guess that prompted you, I guess, to shut down Indie Media and not to have anything to do with it, right?
That was one of the factors, along with the personal attacks that some members of the community, not people connected with Indie Media, but members of the community were making, commenting on my posts. I just decided it really wasn't a forum that was worth investing more time in. So, are we allowed to speak her name on the air?
Yes, the infamous Becky Johnson, Tremble. Becky is a producer of this show, and she's a writer on numerous topics. I believe her strongest suit is homeless issues. She, however, has been writing a lot recently on, what I consider pro-Israeli government propaganda, but she might say is, you know, defense of the Israeli nation. Who knows? In any case, she has a right to her view, and I think she should not be censored for her view. She's been demoted, in essence, in a revisionist rewrite of history at Free Radio. I continue to mention this every time. I'm not quite sure why, but I do. I guess it's because it's unfair, and I don't like this kind of crap happening in my community, whether it's Rotkin criminalizing homeless people or a collective rewriting history on whether somebody is a de facto, if not a de jure, member of the collective, as she has been for years, until she was kept out by two amiable thugs from the resource at standing at the door of the Resource Center for Nonviolence about 2 months ago. An unfortunate situation. Anyway, this is about the transit strike, and if you want to talk about the transit strike, I want to hear more. I I'm looking at the indie media discussion of this, and there is some concern about the fact that there not much warning was given about the strike. Now, when I talked to the head of the, or the vice chair of the state UTU, who was down in a business suit supporting, and then later in more less formal garb, supporting the picketers yesterday, maybe even today, he said that it wasn't that we wanted to catch people by surprise. In essence, it was the transit district that initiated the strike by rejecting the contract. They already voted to strike. They were going out on strike, and that really was the deal. So, you know, people should have, and the on Friday night is when the trans, you know, the district actually made the decision. Actually,
Friday morning,
correct. And so they went out on, I guess, Monday night, was it? I think it was Monday night.
Yeah, Tuesday midnight, 12:01 Tuesday morning. Right. But, you know, smoke is coming out of my ears because that was the third threatened strike date of the month from the union. That was number three.
That's a good point. They had previously made threats to go on other strike days. So you felt that it would have been fairer to give them people more warning.
Well, and I tried to because I saw that coming, very frankly, and I used the Riders Union website, and just to mention this to people, they can go to iridethebus.org and get information about what transportation alternatives are available. There's not much, but we are updating that every day, sometimes more than once a day, to try to keep people informed. But I did post a warning there. I let it flow through the weekend, and then Sunday night, Monday morning, I saw that things were getting bad. On Monday, the union began disrupting service, so that, you know, it was obvious that something bad was going to happen. They had done that earlier in September at the end of August as well.
Now, we have a softball for you here, Paul, from the Woman of Steel. She wonders, do you think that a lot of these labor disputes will be solved with universal health care, such as a single-payer health care? You know, is the Pope Catholic? Does a bear shit in the woods? All that sort of, the questions of that sort.
I think that would solve one aspect of this, but the constant pressure, the relentless pressure for more and more and more will not be solved. The gap between what people expect and how much revenue is coming in is not going to be solved. And I'll tell you very frankly that from 2002 to 2004, three actual years, the UTU drivers, every single one who was not laid off, got a raise of between 15% and 21%. There's no way that taxes could go up that quickly. There's no way that we could raise enough money to pay for that forever.
How did the cost of living index went up at what percentage?
For the total, in those 3 years, the total was just under 6%, about 2% a year.
So you say their wages increased three times the cost of living?
Many times. Six versus, yeah. So if between,
does that include health care?
Yeah. And yes, cost of living does include health care. And Mike Rodkin disagrees with me on this, but you can go and read the journal from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
What about rents?
Yes, rents included. And mortgage equivalent.
You think these figures are accurate?
Oh, they are. I've looked at them myself. I look at the predicted rent for the area, and those are questions that are very serious.
So rents in the last 3 years have gone up, or in the last, between 2002 and 2004, actually, I guess at the beginning of 2005, have only gone up 6%.
Well, the cost of living is made up by many things. Rents have actually been stable to declining statistically. Where we've seen increases, obviously, health care, food, energy costs.
In Santa Cruz County, rents have been declining?
If you look at the statistics, you'll see these reports from the agency that tracks rents in major commercial properties, Schaefer Road, Chestnut Street, other places like that in the county. Those rents have actually been stable to declining, and San Jose is the best example.
I have never heard of a declining rent in Santa Cruz County.
I have had a declining rent.
Really?
I've had declining rents since 1998.
So, specifically, for example?
I'm not going to release the amounts of money that I pay on rent, but my rent here in Santa Cruz, right in downtown, has declined.
Wow. But is this because you've threatened to move out, or they just decided to get nice to you? They like you as a tenant?
No, it's because the building was vacant. It's because there were unrented units when the building was built.
Because these cheesy speculators can't squeeze enough out of people, so they have to drop the rent a little bit?
This is not to say that that's everybody's experience, but the overall effect is that rents are pretty stable. That is not our big worry. Health insurance is going up. Energy, you know, we had a 40% increase in our electric rates. Our water rates are more than doubling. Those are areas where people have to be afraid here in Santa Cruz and in California, in the country, all over the country. But thankfully, energy, water rates, food, other things like that are just one part of a person's budget. And just to take the devil's, play devil's advocate for a moment, people who own property, who are lucky enough to do that, have reaped major gains in the last few years by refinancing their homes, and their interest rates are lower than they've ever been in 40 years. So even that lucky category of people has seen a reduction in its housing costs. But we're in a situation where now the price of property is rising faster than rents.
Well, again, I'm looking on the UTU site. I have to admit that in this discussion, you and I have talked on the air about this before, although, as I said, you've been reluctant to come on the last couple months for fear of precipitating a strike. Let me ask you about that. I mentioned it before. Do you want to discuss that? I mean, I was really hoping to get you and Bonnie Moore mano a mano, you know, either answering each other or obviously not answering each other, so people could make up their minds as to who was ducking which questions. And I haven't been able to do that, which kind of depresses me, because I, you know, not only do I love a good cat fight, but I also think that useful information can be exchanged. And also, you guys are not on bad terms, you and Bonnie, right?
No, we're not at this point. But it
after this show, of course, you're
listening. Yeah, I don't know. We haven't talked in some time. I haven't been at the last board meeting, But you know, I don't like cat fights, and what I don't like is that, you know, our listeners here are hearing one side of the story, but we have this, you know, as you pointed out, 185-page document
available,
which has the truth
where?
In it. It's not available. If you go to the local23.org, the UTU website, and click the contract link on the left, you'll find that that document is protected and not available to the public. It is a public document, and if you go to Metro and ask them for a copy, they will produce one for you. It's your contract. You signed it between the taxpayers and bus riders and the employees of the district, but the union doesn't want you to see it. That was my fault, because I brought that up several years ago, that at a board meeting I said to the board members, well, you know, you may not have read your paper copy of the contract, just go on the web to local23.org. That afternoon, the contract was put behind closed doors and hidden and protected.
Seriously?
Yes.
What year was this?
That was 2003.
And who is responsible for that, do we know?
I have no idea.
Well, I'm looking at the UT.
No, the local. Go to local23.org. That's our local Santa Cruz.
And what's the website again?
Local23.org.
Local23.org. I'm going there.
And Metro Contract is in orange on the left.
And Metro Contract. Here we go. You have to have your name and password to get into the Metro Contract. This is shocking. Now, have you taken the liberty of posting the contract yourself on your own website?
I had. I've taken it down because our old Writers Union website had a spam problem. It was a Yahoo group, a free site. So I don't have it posted anymore, but I can email it to anyone. If you want to get in touch, just send an email to info@metrowritersunion.org, and you will receive a copy of the contract if you'd like. Or you can also contact Metro, because it is a public document.
Perhaps the Metro site has it available.
No.
That doesn't either. Has this happened elsewhere? Have other documents from the union site disappeared after you made some public reference to them?
No comment. I don't want to. I don't want to revisit an unpleasant past.
I know you don't. Therefore, I will. I recall a cartoon critique and commentary that happened, which you pointed out as sort of some racist cartoons were on the website and they disappeared. I wasn't really so much referring to that. I was referring to any other substantive information.
Not that I've noticed. Those cartoons were pretty substantive. One of those wound up in federal court as evidence of Metro employees supposed anti-disabled attitude. So the union badmouthed the district and made the district look as though it was opposed to people with disabilities, and that cartoon wound up in federal court as an exhibit.
In defense of the Metro District in opposition to the
in
union?
In opposition, by people with disabilities in opposition to Metro.
In opposition to Metro the union or Metro the district?
Well, there is just Metro the district, but in this case, a union product, which was negative toward people with disabilities, the union posted had the effect of speaking for all of Metro.
So we have a situation that was pointed out to me before, actually, when I raised a question on the Indy Media website, that you have the union and you have the the Metro District, and then you have the Transportation Commission that makes these decisions, or is it the board of the Metro District we're talking about?
Yeah, Metro is its own, it's a unit of the state of California, and it has an 11-member board, and the board is drawn mostly from the city councils in this county, and then the county also appoints three people. There's a mix of civilians and elected officials on the board, and a member from UCSC as well. And the board, again, it's its own group and makes decisions about this. Regional Transportation is a parallel group, the Regional Transportation Commission, that basically doles out state and federal money to mostly federal or state money to the transit district and other groups.
Well, I know that there's some. Some people who agree with you, or perhaps are even more vociferous in their objections to the strike. Bus drivers going on strike. This is a guy called Ozzy Bozo Explosion. Perhaps his name says something about his credibility, but perhaps not. His arguments, what he says is, talk about dumb. Most drivers make around $50,000 a year. Some make $70,000. They have great benefits. They have all sorts of paid holidays and paid time off. They are among the highest paid in their profession in the U.S., Meanwhile, the people who cut their checks are running a deficit. They are losing money, and the bus drivers go on strike. What are you thinking? Okay, boys and girls, what does losing money mean? Stumped? Okay, kids, I'll give you the answer. Losing money means there ain't no more money to give. What part of that don't you bus drivers understand? Get a clue. If it was up to me, all you whiners would be fired tomorrow. Are you looking to fire those bus drivers tomorrow?
Absolutely not. The point of view that I am taking is the one that will save their jobs. In 2002, we had dire financial straits. This was before I was involved. There were dire financial straits at the transit district, and the board made the decision in the same day to provide a string of raises, the 15% to 21% that we mentioned earlier over 3 years, and to start laying people off in the same day. Now, who gets laid off? The junior drivers, the ones at the bottom of the scale. And 27 driver positions, I believe. No, was it? No, a total of 30 positions at the district were defunded that year, while employees at UTU and SEIU, the remaining employees, took home raises. And the next year, they continued to defund positions at various levels. They also increased fares. They cut service. When you cut service, you lay people off. You defund their jobs. Or you entice them to retire, but it's the same thing. There are fewer people working there than before. A moderate kind of contract where you have small gains each year. And that's what this is. This contract is worth about 2.72%. That's the rate of inflation this year. That's very fair. That's what this settlement is worth that the board has imposed in September. And a moderate kind of arrangement like that every year is sustainable. Then you don't have to let people go. You don't have to do this again. I'm trying to save the level of service, and by implication, the people's jobs.
What is your solution? What do you propose to resolve the situation?
I have no idea. This is a decision that the union will have to make, and I hope that the rank and file drivers, in particular the younger people, 41 new people have been hired since, I think, 2000. I hope that those folks, although they're a minority there, will begin to ask questions about what's going on and begin to see how precarious their jobs are. If the union gets what it's asking for here, there are huge costs associated with this, and we've only scratched the surface. They're asking for other things too. But those costs will come in the form of service cuts, job reductions, because there is no extra money coming in to pay for this stuff. And you can't raise fares. You know, fares are a small enough part of the budget. You couldn't raise them enough to cover all of the things that the union would want. So I hope that the younger drivers will think, and I hope work things out. It's a generational divide, younger versus older workers, really.
That's kind of vague, but what particular, if you were to sit down as the arbitrator, what would you propose as a fair deal for both sides?
Well, I'm going to drop a bombshell. I support general leave. I don't say that in jest at all. I think it's a very fundamental
and
right.
General leave, again, is the opportunity to take a month off without pay, but with benefits.
And my definition, the one that I would support, is that you are allowed to come to work or not come to work as you wish. If you decide not to, then of course you will not be paid. You will not receive your benefits for that time, and you will be replaced with someone who is earning no more than you did. So there's no cost to the district. Then every single day, I would extend it down to the level of a day, you could decide whether you wanted to come to work or not. And if you did decide to, then of course you'd be paid. If you decided not to, then there would be someone else available. We would have a pool of retired UTU drivers and other unionized people who would be ready, just like substitute teachers, to come in on days when there were not enough full-time people at work.
What did Bonnie Moore say when you proposed this?
I've actually never floated that by Bonnie, but I know that it deviates from a traditional union view. Unions always seem to want to have their cake and eat it too. But I think if we could have a neutral, a revenue neutral, no cost form of general leave, I'd be all for it. I think people should have the right to decide whether they would like to work or take time off and have as much as they want. I'm not a fan of a paternalistic kind of company that says, well, you get so many days of vacation, you get so many days of this, so many days of that. Just give me the money for the days I work and give me enough that I can tide myself over at the times when I'm not available to work. I would also point out that we have, and the drivers are all eligible for the state's paid family leave program, which is up to 12 weeks of family medical leave, and that overlaps with a federal program, which is unpaid but with benefits of up to 12 weeks for family leave as well. And they have sick leave, and most of them, two-thirds, have between 4 and 6 weeks of paid vacation. But I would support having general leave, a revenue-neutral form of general leave, where you go and you're replaced by a substitute unionized driver in a pool of people who are available to work casually.
You don't, however, support the current settlement that was reached informally between the two sides and which was rejected by the Metro Transit Board?
Well, I don't know the hidden context behind that. Again, because this all takes place in closed session, it wouldn't have been my favorite deal. That's all I can say. But there's got to be a hidden context there, and there's got to be a reason why. Remember that Mike Rodkin is a labor supporter, an inveterate.
I love it.
He is an inveterate labor supporter. He represents AFSCME. He is one of the officials for the local AFSCME chapter.
He's also on the board of directors of the American Civil Liberties Union. That doesn't mean the unruly party ordinance has anything to do with civil liberties locally or the downtown ordinances or anything else he's supported. So
but
I'm sorry.
Look at other people on the Metro Board also. You have
Jan Buttes, who couldn't give a shit about the people in that respect.
I don't know that that's fair. But you do have Emily Riley. You have Stephanie Harlan. You have a number of people who have a strong labor consciousness. And if a body like that expressed reservations about this, and there's got to be something to it. And I think they're doing it because there really is no money, but there's got to be something to it. They've also been badmouthed, and here's a tip for union-minded people: you do not bite the hand that feeds you. Union members have written to the paper and called the board and the general manager slave drivers, and really mean things have been said. And most of the board members have spoken out in the past few months about how that felt when they were working very hard and putting as much money as possible on the table, how it felt to be attacked that way publicly. It's not a good tip. I think the union would have done better by not being rude to the people. Might have gotten more of what it was asking for.
I really regret that we don't have somebody in the studio who can, you know, who can do a back and forth with you, because I'm sure that there would be some more substantive response to this, mainly in the claim that there is money available for this whole process, and that money is being squandered in other ways by the district or being spent elsewhere in ways that. Now I know you reject this. You're smiling broadly.
Oh no, I'm waiting for you to mention management first of all, because that's the one that's always that's the number one target.
You've pointed out that you think that management has been cut to the bone, and you can't get good people for cheaper than we're getting them, and perhaps you would defend Dick Wilson's getting $160,000 a year as a city manager. I don't know. I've felt that him and Barisone and the police chief, for that matter, all need to go and, you know, be replaced and probably be replaced at a lesser cost. But, I mean, again, I don't claim to know. And you have, in fact, studied, and you have gently pulled out a sheet of paper, perhaps showing what management costs throughout the country or in different.
No, this is the neat question you had asked me some time ago about how Metro compares to other transit agencies. Are we top heavy or not? And just to put it in very plain terms, 1 hour of bus service at Metro requires 16 minutes of administrative work. That's by people who are supervisors or who aren't driving and who aren't maintaining the buses themselves. The 1 hour means 16 minutes of admin work. At VTA, the transit system for Santa Clara, which is much bigger, Santa Clara County, San Jose, all of Silicon Valley, a bigger, much bigger agency that should have super efficient operations because it's so much bigger. 1 hour of bus or train service requires 35 minutes of admin work.
What about costs? How much do they pay them comparatively?
That's the same. You know, basically, the people at VTA are earning a lot more. The drivers are slightly higher paid than ours, but the managers are significantly higher paid. Our general manager gets about 150, and VTAs would be in the mid 200,000s.
What about other funds available?
There really are not other funds. The union keeps on suggesting indirectly, or I should say individual members do. I don't know whether it's an official union position or not, but a lot of members have testified to the board, written to the paper, et cetera, suggesting that we cancel, essentially, in effect, the Metro-based project and somehow take the capital money. There's two kinds of money you get from the federal and state governments. Some of the money can be used for running your buses, for paying people's salaries and the ongoing day-to-day expenses, and other money is capital that can only be used for building things, buying buses, heavy stuff that lasts for several years. And the law is very clear about that, and money is either one or the other. So the union has proposed that we borrow, well, not that we borrow, that we actually take the capital money, that we spend it. This is one-time money. It doesn't come to you every year. That we take it. It's illegal. You're not allowed to use capital money for operating expenses. And even if you could, you would have to give up on the Metro Base. It's a bus garage project that the district has been trying to build for, well, really since the earthquake, since 1989. You know, some people are suggesting that we give up on that goal.
And I'm about to give up on this whole program because we aren't getting any response from all you listeners out there. You know, I think one of the problems is it isn't set up clearly enough. I'm really going to beat the bushes and try to find a person who supports the union position more strongly and might take issue with you. I'm going to ask that person to review this hour and invite them to come on the show on Sunday. Are you going to be available on Sunday if we can find such a person?
Yes, I would be.
Because I think that way, rather than this sounding like, you know, an apologia for management or a one-sided show, we'll have different sides. I also won't look like so much of an idiot for supporting the strikers, and perhaps I can hold my head up high. I will say that I put some of the questions that you raised to Bonnie Moore and to Steve Argue, and I got no specific response other than a general characterization of you as a anti-union person, pro-management person, and so forth and so on. Not from Bonnie. I think Steve was more critical than Bonnie was. So, you know, I'm a little bit dismayed that there isn't a more substantive response to this, to your, to what essentially sounds like you put a lot of work into this matter. You got a lot of information here. Yeah, maybe you're leaving out some significant details. Maybe we're not getting the whole story. Maybe you're slanting it in a particular way. Maybe you're engaging in mass hypnosis of a certain kind. Those glasses look particularly ominous for that kind of thing. But, you know, you are putting it out there, and what we're hearing back is silence. And you said that you actually gave up on this issue because you were actually apprehensive that you would persist. Again, this is the third time I've raised this, but talk a little bit about why you didn't come on the show earlier.
Well, one of the problems that I experienced with Indy Media was that, you know, you're facing criticism from people who have not read the labor contract, who don't go to the board meetings, who haven't read the budget, who don't understand the difference between capital and operating funds. These are all crucial questions here, who don't know how the nitty-gritty financial details of employee benefits and all of this. This is hard stuff. It's not easy. I mean, nobody wants to be on the Metro board. Nobody wants to be there as a member of the public. We get two or three members of the public who go every month and make comments, so it's not a fun thing. But so, you know, I was getting criticism from people who didn't have that background. And the criticism in many cases turned to meanness because there were no facts, there was no substantive discussion, no response. All that the people could offer was mean things. I was called a spin doctor in one case. I've been called elitist. I've been called a right-wing extremist, which I find really amusing. Things like that. So, you know, it's very hard. I really hope, and I would like to have that discussion with Bonnie, and I think, you know, in saying I support General Leave, a different version of it, but I support the fundamental idea there. Hopefully there is some common ground. I know Bonnie and I agree also that we'd like to solve the health insurance problem. There are ways to do that, even short of socialized medicine single payer, which will happen someday, I hope. But getting the district out of that awful state-run health insurance racket, public employee retirement system, and having a locally administered health plan, as they do in the city of Watsonville, would be a huge step forward. And I would like to work on that. I think that the union would like to work on that. I know management wants to work on
that. And you, Vic, are announcing your city council campaign even here as we speak, right?
No.
No, not yet. Okay. I have heard that it's possible that we may have a couple of union or pro-union people listening in. If you want to address any questions or comments to Paul before he goes, or before he's not going to, I mean, you're welcome to stay, Paul. I'm going to run through a couple other things. And in fact, maybe you'll have some commentary on them, showing our listeners you're not simply a vicious anti-union, who knows what, you know, because you have spoken quite eloquently against the unruly assembly law, which some would say Mayor Mike Rotkin has foisted upon us with the city council, and which actually gets a rather interesting treatment in the City on a Hill's primer. You might want to check that out there, all you listeners. That's the thing that's kind of a slick free publication. You can find it in coffee shops. It's put out by City on a Hill. There's an interesting discussion of that. That's the law that says if you twice in 12 months police come to your house, you start paying big time through the nose, even if you weren't there the first time, you weren't responsible for it, even if it was some completely different group, and you have to pay both civil and criminal penalties, and it's a pretty nasty ordinance, and some interesting new details are come out. I don't know how accurate they are, but they are interesting. Lancaster may have a law like this, and it's an Amish community. I mean, I'm not sure where Rotkin dredged this sucker up from, or where it came from, where Barisone, found it, our city attorney. I also want to announce quickly that right now, Curtis Relaford, who is the fellow who went to do Louisiana relief, you may remember he gathered stuff at the town clock, clothing, money. I don't think he went to Reno. He may have gone through Reno. And what he did was he delivered that stuff to Louisiana, and he's going to give an accounting and an account of what happened to him in that distressed area, which is now, of course, going to be redeveloped, perhaps a la Cecil Cirillo, with all the best people getting, we're going to get some decent neighborhoods that have a whiter hue, perhaps, in New Orleans. Anyway, I don't know, he's probably not going to talk about that, but he's going to talk about what happened. He's inviting us to a press conference that's happening even now at the Veterans Hall. That's today. I'm sorry I didn't announce this earlier, folks. My apologies. And it's going to be talking about the caravan that went to Shreveport, Bogalusa, New Orleans to deliver 4 truckloads of goods that were donated. And I think he's going to go back. I talked to him briefly on Sunday on the air. Sounds like a nice enough guy. He got down there. He said they needed the stuff, so they apparently still need the stuff, in spite of all the scapegoating, or I should say legitimate blaming, but, only scapegoating because it's a minor level, the dismissal of Brown and keeping on his superior, and then, of course, his superior, Bush, who should, of course, have been impeached several years ago, but nobody seems to be doing that, impeached or removed in some other way, nonviolently, of course. We don't wish to be arrested when we leave the studio here for suggesting extreme measures. That's happening now at the Vets Hall, and I think what I'm going to do is take a brief musical break. Before I do, I'll throw out a few again, remind people what the issues here is. We're in the middle of a metro strike. I guess negotiations are happening now. Who knows? Maybe there's a settlement in the works. But Paul Marcelin Sampson, who is my guest and who is the founder of the Metro Riders Union, iRideTheBus.org is where to find his website. He's proposed that instead of the general unpaid leave with benefits, which he says benefits people with seniority and will cause a massive upsurge in payment for the individuals, the rest of the union, he's proposing something else. And it looks like...
Oh, I think we almost had a call.
We almost had a call.
Oh, dear.
You're claiming that many of the union contentions that the union wages and benefits are rising at 3 times the rate of the cost of living have in the last 3 years, that management is paid relatively frugally and they are using their money well. I don't know, are you saying that? I'm not sure. But anyway, it looks like we may have a caller. Of course, I don't know if it's a caller on the same subject, so we'll see. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert and Paul.
Yeah, I don't want to interrupt what you were saying. I might have some comments. I had some response to the strike.
Please.
Wow, I think it could have been handled better. While I very much support their right to strike, and in a general class sense, I feel that we're on the same team, I think that the Metro drivers are definitely in an income bracket that is superior to almost all of their riders, and just in a totally different level of hardship going without pay for a little while as to the hardship that the riders have to deal with.
I think that's one of your concerns too, Paul, right?
Yeah, and I really appreciate your expressing that. I was going to close my comments with just a perspective that in 2004, Metro drivers, two-thirds of them earned about $49,000 and change, and the median income in the county was $40,000. So there was a $10,000 gap, and
wow,
those drivers have stepped up again now, and they're at $52,000. And this, of course, doesn't include health benefits and all the other things we've talked about, doesn't
yeah.
include the vacation time, other things that people don't get in the rest of the working world.
Wow. Okay. And I want to temper the criticism, because in general I do feel positive about a lot of these things, but or have some positive feelings about the drivers in general, and a lot of them are pretty interactive drivers, and they're doing their part as basically they are a public service union. And I was miffed that on Monday there was only a certain amount, I don't know how many, of drivers who were letting people know, hey, we may strike tomorrow, you know. And some of them are so damn inward, you know, you figure, God, they're fucking halfway on the moon. They're not going to talk to you about anything. They're certainly not going to sometimes tell you something that would really be pertinent for the next day. The other side of it, I definitely had friends who said, yes, a driver told me we may strike tomorrow, da-da-da-da-da, which is absolutely appreciated. I do feel that their job, while it does entail a lot of responsibility and it's kind of a high-stress thing, it's a people job, man. It's a people job, and sometimes they fall short, but a lot of times they don't. So I do want to say I appreciate how there are some wonderful bus drivers, and in general they have a really hard job.
Oh, I agree with you. And you know, I am always put in the place of defending. You know, I get complaints from people, oh, drivers are discourteous and all this. It's crap. I have lived in and used transit in lots of places around the world, and we do have the nicest crop of drivers that I have seen anywhere. On the question of their ability to notify people of the strike, I don't think all of them knew themselves, because I don't know the internal process, but I don't think in this case that there was a new vote on Monday. So,
Okay. You know,
the final... The last nail in the coffin may have been made, the decision may have been made at a higher level, and the drivers themselves may not have known until midnight or shortly before. So,
okay.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. No, that's a good, I mean, I totally, and then in that case, of course, you can't be frustrated with them.
But you can be frustrated with the management of the union in not giving the riders more notice.
Yeah. I thought it, okay. And the rejection of that deal just seems, in general, I think that they have to, the governmental forces have to find a way to put more money into this. And maybe you can go, I can let you get on with your comments, and maybe there can be some other calls, but I'd be interested to know what are some of the behind-the-scenes details of why there isn't the money, why there's such a pinch of these funds.
Okay. Thank you, caller.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, where's the money, Paul? What have you done with it?
It's in my other pocket. Other pair of pants. No, the money for Metro comes mostly in the form of a sales tax on everything we buy, all of the goods we buy in the county. And that's about 70-odd% of the budget, a half-cent sales tax, which is literally half the budget, $15 million, and then another portion of a quarter-cent sales tax that goes to the state and comes back to us. And then about 20, 21, 22, varies from year to year, percent is fares, and then there are some federal grants that make up the difference.
Why not a millionaire's tax like they did to this bogus Proposition 63 that they passed last year?
Well, the thing is that sales tax is starting to creep up. Sales tax is going up 3% this year. That's what's predicted.
But sales tax is regressive, right?
It's not as regressive because prescriptions are exempt, food is exempt, and services are exempt. This is one of the things.
What about a luxury tax?
Well, a sales tax amounts to that because the basic necessities of life are exempt. This is one of the things I ran up against in the No on X campaign, and I did some soul searching to think about that, and I said, in that case, do we tax utilities or do we use a sales tax? If I had to make a choice, I would pick the sales tax because it exempts some essential items.
But there are other taxes that are even less regressive.
True. But we don't have, in the today's political landscape, municipal governments in California have very limited choices. They can do sales tax. They can do property tax. They can do, you own a piece of property, you pay $100 every year. That's a parcel tax.
What about a transfer tax, sir?
And they, in some cases, but transfer taxes are not a sure bet. They can be opposed. The transfer tax is a difficult one. You can do it, but there you could argue that it's an impediment to interfering with interstate commerce or other things like that. Transfer tax is a hard.
Phone lines are open, 427-3772. Paul, Marcel, and Sampson and I are waiting for your many calls. And again, if you don't call now, well, we're just going to force him to come back on Sunday. So you better call now so you can avoid him on Sunday. That's my suggestion. 427-3772 is a phone number to call in. 831 is the area code if you're outside the area. And, you know, give a call in if you'd like, and we will proceed with that. Let me just kind of jump to another subject, the unruly assembly ordinance that was passed this summer by the city council at the height of the summer, when according to this article in the City on a Hill primer, the head of the student senate, who's also involved with, I guess, Democratic Party politics or something, if I got this right, is he heard about it the day before it was supposed to come up, and so he stayed up till 4 in the morning researching it. And you may remember, if you watched the discussions on July, I guess it was in June, and then again on July 26th, when some of the not really modifications, but clarifications were brought forward, he spoke, as a whole line of students spoke, opposing it. The unruly assembly, however, must wait for the unruly callers. Hi there, caller. You're on free radio.
Yeah, I don't really know what's going on with the metro strike and the drivers. I guess I haven't really been up to speed reading the papers what the drivers are actually demanding.
Uh-huh.
Can you just refresh me with that? What they're actually wanting?
Give them a 30-second update there, Paul.
Okay, they had asked for reduced health insurance rates, which they received, and they had also asked to keep, in addition to 4 to 6 weeks of paid vacation, which two-thirds of the drivers get today, that's anyone who's been there 5 years or longer, they've asked for the right to continue having a so-called unpaid vacation called general leave. The first month they get benefits, and then after that, no benefits. But that's what they want in addition to their paid vacation.
Okay.
Oh, that's one it. Other thing also is that they have asked... there's a new law that requires a meal break, a 30-minute unpaid meal break in the middle of the day, and there's some discussion back and forth about whether drivers would prefer a short 8-hour day and a waiver of the meal break or whether they want the meal break, and that's another issue.
But there was an agreement to, you know, between management and labor at the at negotiations, which was torpedoed by the Metro Transit Board. Do I have that name right? Is that what it is, the commission, the Metro Transit?
It's just a board. Metro is the board. The board is they're the trustees.
So the negotiators they reversed their own negotiators' agreement.
No, because the negotiators, it sounds as though the negotiators struck an agreement that they had not been given the authority to make. The negotiating team, the board gave them parameters, said you have this much money to work with, these are the rules, and it sounds as though they didn't respect those rules. I don't know, because it's all closed session.
I'm not sure why you would say it sounds that way, because they never that phrase has never come out in the papers or been mentioned at city council.
Otherwise, de facto, they would have approved it.
Well, maybe. Caller, any other questions or comments?
Oh, that does it for me. I appreciate it. I appreciate the show. Thanks.
Sure. We hope to have a debate on Sunday on this issue between 9:30 and 1 in the afternoon, if we can round up a union man or woman.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
31. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. 427-3772 is the number to call. We're going into the second hour. Actually, we're almost in the middle of the second hour, and you're getting close to it, of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. My broadsides are here. My bathrobe is not. But I do have guests Paul, Marcel, and Sampson in the studio, and you can call in, 427-3772. We have a somewhat questionable fundraising proposal, growing marijuana and selling it on the 6 acres in Arena Gulch, the Michael Tomasi solution to the budget. But we have a caller, so I'm sorry, I'm not going to allow you to answer that at this time. Hi, caller, you're on free radio.
Hi, Robert. How you doing? It's the other Andrea.
Hey, other Andrea.
I just wanted to call and check in with you. I don't have much to say about the strike thing, but I wanted to call in because I wanted to say thanks for all the work that you've done, like, since we've met with the medical marijuana thing, and I heard Lisa call in last Thursday night, and I'm happy to say that I was able to go to Greenway for the first time last Friday my birthday, and they were so nice that they gave me a nice little birthday care package to take home, so I really appreciate it. And Lisa, if you're out there listening, Lisa Molyneux, thank you so much for your hospitality, and everybody there.
Andrea, you are the same woman who went to city council time after time asking them to address the issue of changing their law so a club could open, and they essentially ignored you. I guess Michael Tomasi at one time, the king of marijuana, might have... I don't want to suggest any kind of unlawful exchange of goods, but
right.
The only person in town giving away medical marijuana may have been the king of marijuana, for all I know, although I don't wish to suggest that's necessarily the case. Lisa actually says she's been open now for, I guess, a week and a half, or a week now.
Yeah, last Wednesday. I heard her say last Thursday night that she opened last Wednesday, and I was glad because I heard her say before they were going to open on Monday, and I went by there, and there wasn't anything going on yet. And then so I was waiting. I had a feeling she was going to call into your show and give us the scoop.
She did.
So I was like, I go in tomorrow, and it's my birthday.
Congratulations. I mean, let's hope that, and I actually had an interesting interview planned with a man who had his marijuana taken from him twice. He's a homeless person.
Yes.
By police. And I'm talking about Santa Cruz Police Department, great enlightened police individuals that
mm-hmm.
Mayor Mike Rodkin sees no need to oversee with citizen police oversight.
Right.
And then he's still trying to get his medical marijuana back. He came up to me yesterday. He told me he didn't want that broadcast on the air. He was apprehensive about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't play that interview. All I can do is mention that it
right.
happened, and that he was sent by the judge. Said you can get your marijuana back. You have a card. You know I don't know why they took it away from you.
Mm-hmm.
He went in to the police department to get it. They sent him to the property. The property said no. You got to get a letter from your attorney. So
wow.
Now he's got to go back to court because he doesn't have an attorney. I mean, it's just amazing the kind of bullshit people have to go through. And I'm glad Lisa now has, apparently, at least on an informal basis, some kind of low-income approach where if you haven't got much money, you can get some medical marijuana.
Yeah, I haven't gotten a chance to speak with her about that yet, but you know my situation. I would definitely be needing some sort of, like, a serious waiver. That's why I appreciated that so much because I didn't expect that, you know. I was like, I went in there and I told the guy, look, it's my birthday today, and I just want to go home with something.
It happens to be my birthday, too. I may have to go in and check out the same thing. Thanks, Andrea. I'm going to run on you.
Your birthday was the 23rd?
No. It's actually in May. But let's pretend, shall we? Bye-bye.
Uh-huh.
Phone line's open. Sorry to cut you off, Andrea. I'm trying to get some calls in quickly here. 427-3772. Paul Marcelin Sampson and I'm not sure if it's his birthday or not, but everybody else is not going to be able to go down and do much cake buying if they have to use buses as their transportation. They can, hitch a ride. We have a caller. Hi, caller. You're on free radio. I guess you're not. 427-3772 is the number to call, and we'll try again. You're on free radio, we hope. Hello? My goodness.
Oh, dear.
Could this be a sinister action by someone? Who knows? Probably not. One more time.
Okay.
We hope you're on free radio. Are you there?
Hello?
Hi. Who's this?
I'm on a cell. I'm going to have to wait till I get to landline.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. How long are you going to be before you get to a landline? We hope you get there. Call in. While we're waiting for landline, you can do the cell line. Hopefully it's a cell and not a cell phone and not a cell. 427-3772 is the phone number to call here for chatting with Paul and Robert on a number of issues, the main one being the Metro strike. I really wish there were a place you could get there. I used to love these little booklets that would have the pro and the con side by side, but actually that's kind of artificial. You usually have to do the kind of legwork and research work that you do, Paul, which is to really go to the original documents, read them over, call people up to confirm them, see what's happening, and get to the sources yourself, which can be time-consuming and also rather discouraging. I know you've been trying to put this stuff out, and you haven't found it too receptive an audience. However, we have an audience at last here. You're on Free Radio. Hello. Hi. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, are you there?
I'm sorry. I tried again. I'm going to have to do landline. It's not working.
Go
I
for
apologize.
It.
I apologize. I cannot hear you.
No problem. No problem,
sorry.
Babe. I think I recognize that woman, and hopefully she'll call in and get back to us. Paul, you're looking pensive. Any thoughts you wish to? Any comments? Any?
Well, I did. I just wanted to end again with these two observations. I want people who are listening to compare their own situations with those of the bus drivers, and we judge the merits of this dispute. Again, the median income in Santa Cruz County last year was $40,000, and the bus drivers were already earning two-thirds of them. $50,000, and that has gone up again, and it doesn't include the benefits and other things that they receive. So the question on the table is, should they receive more? Should we continue? Remembering that everything, any request that a union makes comes down to a financial cost. So that's a question for people to ask. Where are you on the economic ladder relative to these people, and can you afford as a bus rider or as a taxpayer to give up more so that they can have still more? And then also on the health insurance side, the average American worker who has health insurance, and of course many don't, but among those who do, spends $225 on family health insurance every month. And Metro drivers, as of September, are spending $115 on a very good, well, I called PERS, the Public Employee Retirement System, a racket earlier, their health insurance plan at least, and it is. But the coverage itself is very rich. It's just the amount that they charge for it. It's excessive, and someone's pocketing the difference in Sacramento. But that's a separate issue. But again, Metro drivers are paying $115 a year for family health coverage. The average American worker who's lucky enough to have family health coverage is paying $225. So I hope those numbers will help you judge the merits of this dispute. I think that the drivers have already received a fair settlement, and I think the September 1 situation was a good one for them under the circumstances, and a good one for the riders and for the taxpayers who are holding the bag, too.
Well, again, I'm hoping that having laid out some of the issues, Paul, that we'll be able to get some response from union members about whether this is a sweet seniority deal for some of the folks at the top, and whether your proposal about there being a kind of a, what, unpaid, unbenefited general leave of a much more flexible sort be a viable alternative that drivers might propose as a cost-cutting measure, you know, for this contract. I mean, who knows? We're all on the outside, kind of not even looking in, because it's all dark in there and you can't see what's going on the inside. To the ignorant, your ignorant host here, it sounds like a reasonable proposal. And again, I'm somewhat dismayed that the work you put into all this has been essentially dismissed, sometimes with name calling, sometimes with sort of brief, seemingly uninformed commentary. And there's not been a real discussion. I often complain that when I debate Rotkin or raise questions with him, which he allows me to do in the privacy of his office, and sometimes even comes into the studio. That's Mayor Mike Rotkin, also on the transit board, one of the people that the board drivers suggest you contact. By the way, if you want to get some changes, Rotkin's number is 459-4601 up on campus, and it's 420-5023. Actually, that's the number you can be sure of reaching him at. He probably has a machine at both numbers, but it's easier for me to remember. That's his city council message line, 420-5023. He's on the board, so, of course, is Emily Riley, 420-5020, and then you have to dial an additional number that they'll tell you, and you can get into her line. If you want the board to come back and grant the current proposal, approve it, or renegotiate quickly, there are two people you can call in the city, and there's a number of other people. There's Mike, is it Keogh or Keogh, or how do you pronounce
Keogh.
It? Keogh. Keogh. So G-H is silent. And his number is 4380333. I see they have everybody's residences here too.
Yeah, I think that borders on unethical. There are some privacy concerns here, but I'd also suggest that people call UTU Local 23, and I imagine that they're in the phone book. Their number's on the top left there, also on that screen.
Yeah, UTU number is 4296707.
Maybe ask the union to moderate some of its demands too, because it takes two to tango.
So there you are, both sides. And while you're rushing to your phones to help resolve this strike, because you don't just want to be a person who has your car all gassed up and is ready to roll while everybody else sits around at the bus stop or actually sits at home wondering where they're going to get a ride from, you want to help solve this problem, right? So make a few phone calls, put a little pressure on these clowns, and see if we can get some action. And hopefully we're going to get some more discussion on this on Sunday. I've been doing more walking these days because I'm downtown more, but I don't use the bus as much, so I'm hardly one to really talk on either side of the issue, at least as far as a rider goes. You are yourself a rider or more of a biker or more of a driver?
I have two ways of getting around, my own 2 feet and the bus.
And the bus. So you're one of these questionable idealists who has some sort of phobia about cars.
No, I just make an economic choice. Now, I was accused on Indie Media. Oh, there's a call.
Okay. Hey there, caller. You're on free radio.
Yeah. It seems like wouldn't it be so much more helpful in many situations if each side could look at what they could do to resolve it instead of blaming the other, you know? And I would relate it to some of these hearings where it's like you see Congress, like, on and on, just, like, fucking moralizing or criticizing what somebody's fucking doing. Why don't any of these people who are in front of Congress tell them to fucking fuck off and look at the various incongruencies and corruption that is rife in their own administration? Two examples being the hearings about fucking corruption in baseball and sports and steroids and stuff, and also these recent FEMA hearings. They're like lambasting this guy Brown, where the whole fucking corrupt structure is... rife in actual questioning. The people who questioning them are so fucking corrupt. This dude from New Orleans was so outraged that Brown would criticize New Orleans, which is just like a cliche that the administration and that the local and the city officials there are corrupt. Just, it's outrageous, man. It's
I hope you're not calling our mayor Rodkin corrupt.
Yeah, that was irritating to hear that Rodkin had a fucking hand in this. It is so frustrating. It's just like, whatever the reasons are, they're obviously failing, and then the quotes that you get in the paper, which I'm sure are edited and all, but it seems to me that they're just trying to deflect the blame to somebody else, which I don't know really who that would be. It's obviously a dysfunctional situation, and it's sad to me, too, that there's people who it's really affecting. Like, I have a friend who's on SSI who physically cannot ride a bike, and so he has to walk everywhere he wants to get now. It just seems like fucking society failing us, man.
That's a good point. I think we all have to look. We can turn this into something positive immediately. If there are people listening who have cars, please call 429-POOL. That's the carpooling number from the county. It's free, and you can offer a ride to someone. If you happen to be going to the store and you know you're going that afternoon, call and register, and then someone else can be matched up with you, and
that's
you
great.
Can make a difference that way. There's a tremendous need. Also, if you're taking your children to school, those are the two main areas, going to the grocery store and taking your kids to school.
Okay.
Call and register, 429-POOL.
Yes, I know. Okay, exactly. Definitely turn it into something positive instead of just being frustrated. I totally hear you, and it's a blessing that Paracruise is still going on. Because I work with the elderly, and it really affects, things like this, they really affect everybody, and that to me is the most important measure or one of the really important measures of what a society is doing. It's like how it's treating the children, the elderly, and the disabled, people who really need these services, and I think we see that the focus is not mainly here, and I'm sure that could be related to war spending and all these other things on a larger level. But I'm definitely a member of the working poor. I mean, I'm categorized as white, but definitely among the lower income brackets. So I do see it from that perspective, and I see the cross-section of people who are riding the bus.
Thanks, caller.
Thanks. The caller also brought up another point here about corruption and about societies not doing everything possible to help those who are in need. And I'll give you another very specific, immediate example. The Regional Transportation Commission funds a program called TaxiScript. If you are on a low income, if you are elderly, or if you have a severe disability, you qualify, and you can receive these coupons every month that give you a discount on your taxis, so you still have some independence in moving around. That's one of the few programs that could help people out right now. And as it turns out, because the Regional Transportation Commission is so hands-off, and that program is administered by Community Bridges, by a nonprofit, and the Community Bridges never purges the list of people who get the TaxiScript, and not all the coupons are claimed. Basically, the program has a backlog, and it's not available to newcomers. And there are coupons not being claimed. There are people who have moved out who aren't eligible anymore. And the Regional Transportation Commission is totally hands-off on that issue and passes the buck to Community Bridges, and this nonprofit agency that everyone thinks is great passes the buck to. So that's another action item if you want. Call the Regional Transportation Commissioners. You can look on their website, sccrtc.org, and find their numbers. You need to call the commissioners, not the reception. Just look for the list of the commissioners and start calling them, because they're responsible for that program.
Let's take a musical break. But while I'm breaking, remember the phone number here is open, 831-427-3772. I will be keeping an eye on the phone blinker. So if you call in, I will put you on the air. Call in.
Round the stick of T-Burrow's escape. Show and get tall with me.
That was more of the music of Eli Charleston, the street jazz man who hasn't been seen in Santa Cruz for a couple weeks. Maybe he'll be back. It's Ragged Time with Eli. He has a website somewhere in case you want to catch his stuff. I'm looking. www.elicharleston.com. That sounds easy enough. He's got a nice sound to him. This is Free Radio, 101.1 FM and freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse. This is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And the phone lines are open. 427-3772 is the phone number. Area code 831-427-3772, in case you happen to be out of the area. If you want to call me off air, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F. Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom is the organization that that number is affiliated with, but it's also my line. It's a message phone, but you can catch me there, and I will call you back. 423-HUFF, 423-4833 is the number to call. Got some interviews from the anti-war rally in Santa Cruz last Saturday. I was a little gloomy at the turnout in Santa Cruz, and, of course, at the continuing war. That's what really makes us all pretty gloomy. We don't know what to do. It just seems outrageous. Our anger and frustration grows. We don't know what the hell to do. But, you know, as little things are leaking out in the news here, which I kind of want to mention briefly. Let's see here. Let me zip into the right website, and I can actually give you the latest. I'm going to go to Al Jazeera, which some think is not the most objective site. It's a Middle Eastern site, but it's... I have not seen it seriously contradicted in my research, and I tend to go to a variety of sites, and they usually are reprinting stuff from places like Reuters and AP. Of course, today the main stories are scores killed in triple Iraqi car blasts, 85 people killed in three apparently coordinated car bomb attacks in the mixed Shia and Sunni Arab town of Balad. Balad Police Lieutenant Abdel Abdullah said bombs went off about 6:45 p.m. local time. In a busy market, they hit a bank, a vegetable market, another location. Roadside bomb killed five American soldiers. That blast was the single deadliest attack on U.S. forces since a roadside bomb killed 14 on the 3rd of August. That makes 13 U.S. service members killed over the past 4 days. Also, we have a U.S. court ordering the release of Abu Ghraib photos. Pictures of detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib must be released, even though they could damage an American image, according to U.S. District Judge Alvin K. Hellerstein, because terrorists in Iraq and Afghanistan have proved they do not need pretext for their barbarism. The ACLU have been looking for the release of 87 photographs and 4 videotapes as part of an October 2003 lawsuit demanding info on the treatment of detainees in U.S. custody. This was months before the Abu Ghraib scandal. General Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had maintained in court that releasing the photos would aid al-Qaeda recruitment. Of course, the reality of continuing abuse will not aid recruitment, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. That it would weaken the Afghan and Iraqi governments, that it might, and incite riots against U.S. troops. Yeah, probably would. But what they need to do is change their policies, obviously. However, this ruling is expected to be appealed, which could delay the release for months. Still, it was another nail in the coffin of the situation. Not a nail in the coffin, but I say an encouraging sign. Another outrageous thing that came up was U.S. forces have, according to this story from AP, raided the homes of two officials from a prominent Sunni Arab organization, arresting bodyguards, confiscating weapons. Adnan al-Dalami, Secretary General of the Conference for Iraqi People, said soldiers and in tanks and Humvees with two helicopters circling overhead, broke into his home at 2:30 a.m. local time on Thursday, put his family and himself in a guest room and searched the house. Quote, it was as if they were attacking a castle, not the home of a normal person who advises Iraq's interim government and has called for reconciliation and renounced sectarianism, he told a news conference after the raid. Al-Dulami, who is a prominent critic of the Shia-led government, said the troops arrested four of his bodyguards, confiscated their licensed weapons, said the Americans were acting on false tips that linked the men to the insurgency. This act of humiliation derails our efforts to encourage Sunnis to take part in the political process, he said, urging the U.S. government to stop such actions. Another raid took place at the Baghdad home of Harith al-Abedi, another senior official in the organization. Said Iraq's largest political party, the Iraqi Islamic Party. Again, these are attacks on the Sunnis. The U.S. military said it had conducted several raids in those areas of Baghdad on Thursday, but couldn't identify the homes of the Iraqis involved, I'll bet. The chief of Iraqi police in the district, Major Musa Abdul Karim, said he heard reports of the raids after they took place, but the U.S. military had not coordinated with the Iraqis. So sovereignty doesn't mean anything in Basra, where British tanks can smash into a jail and kill people to get out two of its undercover folks. And apparently it doesn't mean anything in Baghdad, where U.S. troops can raid invade the homes of major Sunni Islamic politicians without any kind of say-so or go-ahead from the Iraqi government. The Conference for Iraq's People and the Iraqi Islamic Party are two leading political organizations representing Iraq's Sunni Arab minority, which has increasingly complained of abuse as U.S. and Iraqi forces pursue insurgents, the bulk of whom are Sunnis. And these two groups are, coincidentally enough, campaigning to defeat a draft constitution in the 15th of October referendum, believing it will divide Iraq into Kurdish, Shiite, and Sunni areas, with the Sunni one having the least power and revenue, not to mention, of course, a Shiite clerical state will be set up at the same time. The Iraqi Islamic Party condemned the two raids as a savage act and an unjustifiable aggression, saying such treatment of good Iraqis could set back efforts to persuade citizens to join efforts to improve security in the war-torn country. And again, that's from the AP on the Al Jazeera website. In England, in an article from Reuters, also on the Al Jazeera website, Britain's Tony Blair has apologized to an 82-year-old man ejected from the annual conference of his Labour Party for heckling over Iraq. And what happened here is the heavy-handed removal of Walter Wolfgang on Wednesday backfired on the Labour leadership. Burley Stewarts grabbed Wolfgang and bundled him out of the conference on Wednesday after he interrupted Foreign Secretary Jack Straw as he said British troops were in Iraq to help build a secure and stable country and would stay as long as needed. That's a lie and you know it. Rubbish, shouted Wolfgang, a refugee from Nazi Germany and a party member for 57 years. That's a Labour Party member. Wolfgang was briefly arrested using anti-terrorism powers. People are perfectly entitled to freedom of speech in our country, and I'm really sorry about what happened to Walter, and I've apologized to him, Blair told BBC television. Of course, you don't hear about people interrupting Bush's speech much because they control the crowds. And apparently the news media people are too concerned about keeping their jobs to call a lie to Bush's face. And that's the reason he continues his charade in that particular way. What else have we got? I found a positive sign yesterday was there were no less than seven, count them, seven Iraqi stories in the Wednesday Washington Post. That's the main Washington, D.C. newspaper. Woman suicide bomber kills five in Iraq. I don't know if you read that story. It's the first time they've verified that there was a woman suicide bomber was involved in this was a suicide bomber. There was a reservist sentenced to 3 years. That was, Lindy England for her Abu Ghraib abuse. Of course, no prosecutions of any of the higher-ups. Blair was defending policies on Iraq. There was a story about how Zarqawi has hijacked the insurgency. This is the mythology of the Bush and Blair administrations, that somehow this is all a terrorist plot in Iraq that has to do with either foreign terrorists, of course, the British in the U.S. aren't foreigners, you know. They're all very Iraqi, right? No, foreigners, you know, Saudi Arabians and Syrians who all snuck into the country, and all they have to do is seal the borders. And if that were really true, of course, they could have put troops along the borders and actually sealed the borders, but they never did under Rumsfeld's, you know, lean and mean military, which he brought in with this bomb them to death, and then they'll greet you with flowers approach that he helped invade Iraq with. Another story in the Washington Post yesterday, a bomber is caught inside Baghdad's fortified green zone. First time, apparently, that a suicide bomber made it inside the green zone. Things aren't going so well in Iraq. Turkish woman blasts Karen Hughes with Iraqi war criticism. This was a story Democracy Now! Covered, which, so I don't really have to go into any detail, much detail on it. Karen Hughes is a Bush flack who went to Turkey, and she was interrupted, apparently, by some of the normally compliant people seeking U.S. money from groups that were not seeking U.S. money. Turkey, you may remember, refused to allow U.S. troops and bombers to proceed over their territory when they invaded Iraq, and denounced and asked questions of American policy, serious hostile questions. And, of course, Bush claims progress in the war in Iraq. More inane, meaningless propaganda from Bush, repeating the same horseshit. I guess his latest line is that there is more indication of Sunni participation in the forthcoming constitutional vote on October 15th. Of course, the Sunni participation is to reject the Constitution. And, of course, those who are rejecting the Constitution apparently are getting, or some of them, are getting raided by U.S. troops without, who have committed no crime under Iraqi law. If they committed a crime under Iraqi law, the Iraqi government would be arresting them, supposedly, although the Iraqi government is largely a puppet of the American government anyway. But even here, they, you know, they're not even bothering to consult their puppet friends in the Iraqi government. Other stories, U.S. general casts doubt on 2006 troop cut. Too soon to tell, according to a Reuters story, if troops can be brought home. In March and again in July, General George Casey, who commands 147,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, predicted a fairly substantial reduction in American forces next spring and summer if Iraq's political process goes positively and progress is made in developing Iraqi security forces. Pentagon officials said that meant a reduction of perhaps 20,000 to 30,000 troops. So we're going to take out them and then still have 110,000 or 120,000 troops sitting there, provoking more insurgency, more insurrection, more nationalist revolt. You know, imagine if French and British troops, or let's say French and Spanish troops, invaded the U.S. In order to protect Americans from the illegal Bush pseudo-elections of 2000 and 2004. How many Americans would support such an invasion, even if they didn't like Bush? Not too many. Similarly, with the Saddam Hussein deal, foreign troops stationed in a foreign land means domestic insurrection, is what it means. I'm probably not telling anybody who's listening, who normally listens to this station, anything they don't already agree with. And I hope to have on the air, actually, people I respect who have a different opinion so we can debate this issue or discuss it. Good debate of a kind, it's not really that good, but it's kind of fiery, is between Christopher Hitchens and George Galloway. You can get that on the democracynow.org website. It was a long debate, a couple hours. Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Hosted it. Interesting stuff. A lot of personal attacks on George Galloway and some personal characterizations of Christopher Hitchens. Galloway was is a British Labour MP. Actually, he's not a Labour MP. He's got his own party now. He was kicked out of the Labour Party for being too outspoken on the Iraqi war. So, looking again at more stories. Here's a great editorial. Well, an interesting editorial. I was discouraged at the situation with the anti-war protests here. Sort of a small, it wasn't entirely lifeless, but very low-key protest, and went home without doing much. There was no occupations. There was no. It was a small protest in solidarity across the country. Who knows? I mean, I'm looking for feathers in the wind, I guess. Here's a story by Justin Raimondo, The Anti-War Majority versus the Pro-War Elite, September 26th on antiwar.com, a website you can go to. It's got a lot of interesting anti-war stories, at least anti-Iraq war. The massive anti-war demonstration in Washington, D.C. over the weekend, with attendance estimates ranging from 100,000 to 200,000, dramatized what the pollsters already know. The Iraqi war is hugely unpopular, and public opposition is increasing by leaps and bounds. The significance of the September 24th march is that the anti-war majority is finally making itself heard. A recent CNN USA Today Gallup poll showed 67% disapproving of Bush's stay-the-course policy, up nearly 10 points since the last poll taken in the beginning of September. That's interesting to me. Half believe Iraq will never become a stable democracy, and by implication, that will be there forever if George W. Bush and his bipartisan enablers have their way. 65% think we're spending too much in Iraq, and when it comes to policy alternatives, increasing troops, keeping the numbers steady, decreasing the U.S. troop presence, or getting out altogether, the results are respectively increasing troops, 8%, keeping the numbers steady, 26%, decreasing U.S. troops, 33%, and getting out altogether, 30%. According to a recent New York Times CBS poll, half say the invasion was a mistake. That hasn't changed much, I guess. The New York Times CBS poll breaks responses down along party lines, and the results are pretty astounding. Republicans who want to increase the troop level, 12%, Democrats, 8%. The Super Hawks are a tiny minority and not noticeably partisan one way or the other. That is, they're in both parties. Republicans who want troop levels to remain the same, 41%, Democrats, 15%. This shows how out of touch with their base the Democrats are. Most Democratic members of Congress would take the majority Republican position of keeping troop levels the same, even though 41% of the Democrats, only 41% of the Democrats want that to be the case. Republicans who want to decrease the number of U.S. troops in Iraq, 29%. Democrats, 29%. Both Democrats and Republicans are at 29% and wanting to decrease the number of U.S. troops. So it isn't a partisan issue. Sure, there are plenty of stay-the-coursers in GOP ranks who reflexively support the president, but a significant number want to begin the process of withdrawal. This is pretty much the same position as taken by Representative Walter B. Jones, a Republican member of the Congress from a district in North Carolina that has at least 4 military bases. Jones, you'll remember, led the effort to rename French fries Freedom Fries on the Capitol cafeteria menu because Paris didn't sign on to the invasion of Iraq. Jones has now turned against the war and is co-sponsoring a resolution, Homeward Bound, that would begin withdrawing our troops starting in October 2006. Republicans who want to remove all U.S. troops from Iraq right now, 11%. Democrats, 45%. Here we have the biggest partisan gap, but still the number of out-now Republicans is surprising. The amazing fact of the matter is that a full 40% of Republicans either want to begin withdrawing or want out altogether right now. The anti-war movement may not know it yet, but Republicans are probably their fastest-growing constituency. Ralph Nader, practically alone among the speakers at the Washington rally, noted this, praising Representative Jones and making the point that this war is hardly conservative in any meaningful sense of the term. The country has turned decisively against the war. We have reached a tipping point, as I wrote last month, and the rising tide of anti-war sentiment shows no sign of cresting. The water is coming over the levees, but in Washington, D.C., they are oblivious. With gerrymandered congressional districts designed to protect incumbents from the threat of any real electoral challenge, and plenty of money pouring into their coffers from lobbyists foreign and domestic, the war party rules the roost in the imperial city, and they think they can afford to ignore the occasional invasion by the anti-war majority. There are a lot of people here who are wondering, where are the Democrats, said Tom Andrews, the director of the Hollywood-centric Win Without War. This past weekend, the entire Democratic Party leadership fled town, including party chairman Howard Dean, once the great white hope of Democratic war critics. Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and even Russ Feingold, who is positioning himself as the anti-war presidential candidate. Knight Ritter reports the Democrats are wary of the anti-war movement, as well they might be, considering that it was Bill Clinton who signed the Iraq Liberation Act, the legislation that originally authorized action to effect regime change in Baghdad, with the enthusiastic support of top Democrats. That's new to me. The Democratic Party has an identity crisis on this issue. Andrews, a former Democratic congressman from Maine, tells us, we need voices, we need leadership, but fear is driving them. Fear of what or of whom? It can't be the voters they fear, because the majority, as polls show, would back some variant of an anti-war stance. It can't be fear of their Democratic Party base, because as those same polls show, most Democrats want out now. And it can't be the wrath of the mainstream media, which has given sympathetic, albeit tardy, coverage to the growing anti-war movement. It is fear of not being considered serious, of not being the recipient of fat donations from foreign-connected lobbyists, and fear of retribution from the party leadership, Democrat as well as Republican, that keeps Congress in line. What is operating here is the iron rule of the elites in government and in the leadership of the two major parties, who have deemed all talk of withdrawal as unrealistic. This is what dictates the bipartisan line in Washington, which is that we are in Iraq to stay. A recent military appropriations bill authorized spending for the construction of permanent bases in Iraq, and the Democratic leadership voted for it. Indeed, if anything, the Democrats want to spend more money on nation building than the Republicans, and are ready and willing to hike taxes in order to do it. This, mind you, would be awfully unpopular among grassroots Democrats as well as Republicans. 77% of all Americans would disapprove of having to pay more in taxes in order to pay for the Iraq War, according to the New York Times CBS poll, while 55% don't want to give up recent tax cuts to foot the bill. We can't depend on the misleadership of the Democratic Party to get us out of the quagmire. They were in on the Iraq disaster from the beginning, with the Democratic Leadership Council consistently hewing to a hard line and the Democratic Party neocons generally riding roughshod over pro-peace grassroots activists. The convention that nominated John Kerry was a display of unabashed militarism and me-tooism, during which anyone caught with anti-war signs or even buttons was summarily kicked out the door, as happened to Medea Benjamin. There are signs the anti-war movement is waking up to the Democrats' perfidy, with Cindy Sheehan going after Hillary on account of the New York senator's support for the war, which Ms. Clinton describes as a noble cause. Far from advocating withdrawal, Senator Clinton has more than once suggested we need to send in more troops. At the San Francisco demonstration, as I noted on the antiwar.com blog, an entire contingent organized by Code Pink drew attention to Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's consistent support for war funding and other measures that would prolong our presence in Iraq. Awareness is growing, but we need more than that. We need action. If we now have an anti-war majority in this country, then how is the pro-war minority able to carry it off? Glad you asked. The answer illuminates the mystery of how we got into this mess in the first place. Remember that this war was the project of a very small and determined minority, the neoconservatives, who over a decade of dedicated activity, including the long, slow march to the institutions of the GOP and the Washington National Security Bureaucracy, managed to pull off what Colin Powell, via Bob Woodward, characterized as a de facto coup d'etat. They hijacked American foreign policy and the U.S. government along with it. These characters started out, many of them, in the Democratic Party as supporters of the Henry Scoop Jackson wing, itching for a military confrontation with the Soviet Union. It was only later, when the Democrats rejected them in the 1970s, that the neocons switched to the Republicans, and they still have their foot in both camps. Marshall Whitman, a former advisor to the Christian Coalition and a youthful member of the Young People's Socialist League, is now a big wheel at the DLC, along with his belligerently pro-war colleagues at the Progressive Policy Institute, the DLC's think tank. And I will probably pick up on the rest of this story when I return on Sunday. You can always beat me to the punch. You can look at it on the antiwar.org. It's Jason Raimondo's September 26th story about what's called the anti-war majority versus the pro-war elites. And it's interesting and informative. I recommend it. So, thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I got 8 seconds left, so I'm a-leaving. We're going to have Uncle Dennis here, and hopefully we're going to have this station put back in better shape. Whatever happened to our pirate flag? Well, we'll talk about that on Sunday and all lots of other things, too. So, between times...
We want our flag back.
We want our flag back, man. If you burned our flag, we're going to get you. We're going to get you. Okay, then. Call in at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I will speedily, within a week or two, maybe even a day or two, call you back, and we'll talk. And again, hopefully we'll be talking, if a union spokesperson can get on the horn here, with having a real debate on Sunday about what the hell is going down with this metro strike. Thanks.
My mama done told me when I was in knee pants. My mama done told me, son, some woman knows me.
blues in the night. Now the rain is falling, hear the train of calling, wooey. My mama done told me, hear the lonesome whistle blowing across the trail, so wee. My mama done told me, ah ooey, ah ooey, oh, oh, clickety clack, as I echo in back of the blues in the night. Evening breeze will stop the trees to crying, and the moon will hide its light. When we get the blues in the night, take my word, the mockingbird sings the saddest kind of song. He knows when things
away. chill on me, but I know it ain't true. Put on your Madison blues. Put on your Madison blues shoes. I got the Madison blues. Now put on your Madison blues shoes.
I lost my job. She said, that don't confront me, long as I get my money next Friday. Now next Friday I come, I didn't get the rent, and out the door I went. So I goes to the landlady. I said, you let me slide. I have the rent for it tomorrow, the next day, I don't know. So say, let me slide it on, you know, people. I notice when I come home in the evening, she ain't got nothing nice to say to me. But for 5 years, she was so nice. Lord, she would love a dove. I come home one particular evening. The landlady said, you got the rent money yet? I said, no, can't find no job, therefore I ain't got no money to pay the rent. She said, I don't believe you're trying to find no job. Said, I seen you today, you were standing on a corner, leaning up against a post. I said, but I'm tired. I've been walking all day. She said, that don't confront me, long as I get my money next Friday. Now next Friday I come out, I didn't have a rent, and out the door I went. So I go down the streets, down to my good friend's house. I said, look, man, I'm outdoors, you know. Can I stay with you maybe a couple days? He said, let me go and ask my wife. He come out of the house. I could see his face. I know there was no. He said, I don't know, man. She kind of funny, you know. I said, I know. Everybody funny. Now you funny too. So I go back home. I tell the landlady, I got a job. I'm gonna pay the rent. She said, yeah. I said, oh, yeah. And then she was so nice. Lord, she would love it, love it. So I go in my room, pack up my things, and I go.